Good morning, everybody, and a very warm welcome. And it is, as you probably appreciated as you walked in, quite warm. We put the heating on earlier today so that you wouldn't feel the cold. And can I say, well done for turning up on this one of the sort of awful days. There was close betting as to whether there would be more of us in the choir than in the congregation, so it's nice to see a good few numbers. If I could introduce myself, most of you know me as Harold Lorenzelli and a member of the choir. But today I'm taking the service because Sarah is probably at this moment being dug out of a snowdrift somewhere up north in the pursuit of enjoyment, I'm sure. So welcome all. Welcome, a warm welcome to Essex Church, home of Unitarians and all branches of humanity, I like to think. You are most welcome here this morning to this place of worship. Hopefully it will be a time for us to take stock, reflect for a while, mull a few things over before we push the boat out again and join that madding crowd. Each of us has come here by different and various roads, some of us light of step and heart, perhaps in celebration of some event, others with more pressing concerns. I hope this morning provides all of you with a chance to pause and consider not simply one's own concerns, but those of our neighbour too. May we all find some comfort from coming together this morning. I've chosen this morning the poem by John Milton on his blindness. And I've chosen it because this morning's service is about how we deal with circumstances in life which may be beyond our control, be they physical or social, psychological or whatever. The poet Milton went completely blind at the age of 44. I think he lived another good 20 or more years. The talent he refers to in the poem is a direct reference to the parable of the talents in the Bible, in the Gospel of St. Matthew. The poem represents a reasoned argument on the basics of Christian faith for the acceptance of physical impairment. Milton learns that being an obstacle to his fulfillment, Milton learns that rather than being an obstacle to his fulfillment of God's work for him, his blindness is part of that work, and that his achievement lies in living patiently with it. The two notes. The use of the word fondly in the text is used in the sense of foolishly, and by to post, he means to travel. When I consider how my light is spent, half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker and present my true account, lest he returning chide. Doth God exact day labour light denied? I fondly ask. But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly, thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. The extract that I've chosen this morning from an article about Dame Stephanie Shirley. I chose it because it does not deal with personal disability, but that of a relative. Dame Stephanie Shirley, a former technology entrepreneur, is renowned for her generosity. She arrived in Britain as an unaccompanied child refugee before the start of World War II. Her life has been one of extremes, profoundly harrowing and extraordinarily successful, Traumatized by leaving her home and family at the age of 5, she had the heartbreaking experience of caring for her severely autistic son, who died of an epileptic fit. She's had a nervous breakdown and on more than one occasion contemplated suicide. The article came out last year and was in supporting the publication of her book, which is called Let It Go, The Entrepreneur Turned Ardent Philanthropist. And in her new book, she describes how she found hope in the blackest moments of despair, how she refused to be cowed by sexism in the workplace, and how a successful business can be morally sound. She was born in Dortmund, Germany in 1933, the younger of 2 girls. Her Jewish father was a respected judge until stripped of his position by the Nazis. Her mother was Christian. Although Stephanie and her late sister Renate, then aged 9, were fostered by a Christian couple in Britain, she suffered from insecurity and had Jungian therapy for 6 years. Both her parents survived the war, but neither subsequently wanted much to do with her. My father remarried and had another family. I only heard of his death a year after it happened. My mother was always critical of me, the result of the rejection by both parents, but particularly my mother, has driven me to excellence in whatever I do. It is my way of showing her that I can do it. She endured appalling harassment. I remember one occasion in the 70s when I was trying to sell a multi-million pound IT contract to a Tory Minister of State, who I won't name, and he pinched my bottom while we were talking. I got the job, and after that I always dressed like an honorary man in a grey suit and a white blouse. She and Derek married in December 1959, and their son Giles was born 4 years later. At the age of 2, her sweet baby turned into a wild, unmanageable toddler, and within a week lost his ability to speak. He never talked again. Months later, she received the bombshell news that he was severely autistic. Everything we learnt about his condition was like a skewer in our hearts, she says. There were no places for children like Giles. We decided not to have another child, and my husband and I worked in shifts. Derek's career went down the tubes, but he never complained. When you have an autistic child, their needs drive everything else. Giles' moods were extreme and he could be violent. We were in a perpetual state of high alert. The only time I forgot about him was when I was engrossed in my work. Some months were so black, I felt we were living in a horror film. On more than one occasion, I felt the 3 of us should commit suicide. We did not, because Charles couldn't give his consent. I was smoking 60 cigarettes a day, and it put such pressure on our marriage that we separated for some time. Now we are fine, I'm pleased to say. All this led to a breakdown. She was admitted to hospital for several weeks, and Giles, then 12, was placed in an institution. He never lived at home again and died on October 17, 1998, from a fit that was a consequence of his autism. His brain has been donated for research to a brain bank at Oxford University that I funded, she adds proudly. I will never recover from his loss, but I have learnt to live without him and his need of me. Dame Stephanie shows no sign of slowing down. I travel the world to talk about the need for philanthropy. I only have 1/10 of my previous wealth. Does she still feel like a refugee? I came close to annihilation, and deep down my refugee status remains important to me. It taught me that few things in life are as solid as they seem, and that wholesale change, though often terrifying, is not necessarily synonymous with catastrophe. I have done more in the 7 decades since that miserable day when I arrived than I would ever have believed possible. I know that I am a survivor. When I read the title I'd chosen for today's address, which I sent off for inclusion in the church notices some time ago, I have to admit to being quite impressed. Well, then panic set in, of course, when I realised that I was the one who'd chosen the title and had to find something to fit the title. One has an inspiration, an idea, and then you have to fill it out, of course. It's a weighty theme, but it was actually triggered by a conversation I had with an old friend of mine whose personal circumstances had taken a turn for the worse. Her husband had just lost his job. His mother had just gone into a home for dementia sufferers, and to cap it all, her mother declared that she had cut her daughter out of her will. And this just 6 months after her beloved father had died after a battle with dementia. "Is it all my fault?" she asked, with a tone mingling exasperation and not a little desperation. Now, my friend is a resourceful and creative, resilient person who has had to reinvent herself several times in her various careers. Never one to feel sorry for herself, always inspiring in her attitude. But here she was, suddenly, caught up in a web of circumstances which produced this faltering tone. And it set me thinking about how we react to our own personal circumstances. What are the qualities we need to face what life presents us with? Things happen to us, and to survive, we need to look into ourselves and come up with a response which will determine how successful we are at surviving the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as someone once put it. For make no mistake, things do happen beyond our control. Life is full of chance and haphazard circumstances which have no regard for person or property. Now, there are many factors which determine our reactions. They're social, cultural, and genetic. We are shaped by the society we live in, whose ethical standards we absorb, consciously or otherwise, by our subtle interaction with the people around us, by the cultural values of the world we live in, and finally, by forces beyond our control, bred of our family heritage, itself a subtle blend of the social and genetic constraints that we inherit. But beyond these constraints, what control do we have? Is gut reaction enough? Can we separate feelings from facts and learn to live in the world, part of it, but part out of it, so to speak? Not by escaping into some drug-induced nirvana, but being there and living with and through the struggle. The readings and extracts I chose reflect different but complementary responses to the question. In the case of Milton, what shines out is a kind of stoic acceptance of his lot, a refusal to wallow in self-pity, and an attempt to accept with humility the impediments that life has presented him with. His passive resignation is a miraculous triumph of will over his own natural temper. It is far from expressing the permanent bent of his nature. From the time when he was a boy of 12, he insisted on working at his books up to midnight, till his old age, when he was in the habit of fighting the pains of gout with song. His life is the story of arduous, sustained, and often joyous activity. But the poem exudes acceptance and humility, an awareness of the bigger picture and his place in it. Such an attitude of resignation does not preclude sentiment. I'm not suggesting a kind of emotional frigidity by any means. To feel is to be human, but to deal with those feelings goes beyond. Not for nothing is self-consciousness the thing that separates us from the beasts of the field and defines our humanity. I'm reminded of the French poet Victor Hugo. He wrote a poem on the accidental death of his beloved daughter in a boating tragedy just after her marriage. He lists all the reasons for accepting her early death, given the immensity of the universe and God's often inscrutable plan for mankind. He gazes at the grandeur of nature and contrasts it with his own insignificance. Nevertheless, he ends on a poignant note of regret for her passing, a restrained emotional response to the enormous tragedy of her death. The poem acknowledges the suffering at the heart of human experience and at the same time tries to transcend it. The other extract from the article about Dame Stephanie Shirley indicates in some ways a more acute response to the tragedy of her son's early death. Well, we don't know whether Victor Hugo contemplated suicide, but her honest avowal strikes a more somber chord. Yet her life story paints a picture of similar resilience. Filled with the pain of her son's condition, her life is a beacon of selflessness and generosity. Indeed, that seems to be her principal message to us all. You live with and through the pain, and survive by thinking more of others than yourself. In a similarly philanthropic vein, I'm reminded of the recent death of Elizabeth Murdoch, mother to the notorious Rupert, who died at the end of last year at the ripe old age of 104. Her advice on her 99th birthday was, be optimistic and always think of other people before yourself. Selflessness, stoicism, optimism, as opposed to self-regarding pessimism. I've been engaged recently in the study of philosophy. One group who impressed me were the Stoics. I mentioned Milton's Stoic approach to his blindness. Now, the Stoics have had a pretty bad press. We tend to think that they stand for an unemotional response to life's problems, the kind of attitude that led to the stiff upper lip school of thought, that led to such bottling up of emotions in our society. John Hans, who's not here this morning, gave me a little lecture on that subject when I told him what my topic was going to be, hence the inclusion of that. Stoicism, in fact, teaches the development of self-control and fortitude as a means of overcoming destructive emotions. They advocated clarity of thought in an attempt to understand the universal reason, the Greek logos, the basic harmony at the center of nature. They sought to encourage an individual's ethical and moral well-being. In our interpersonal relationships, we should strive to be free of anger, envy, jealousy, and to accept each other as equals. The Stoic amends his will to suit the world. It reminds me of Sartre's injunction that a prisoner is free to reject their chains. The Stoics did not seek to extinguish emotions, but rather to transform them by reflection, clear judgment, and inner calm. Good lies in wisdom and self-control. One must be free from passions such as anguish and suffering. In other words, we must try not to react passively to the world. The ideal is to achieve equanimity in the face of life's highs and lows. The four principal virtues were wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. The path to success lay in understanding the universal reason inherent in all things. Stoicism is a way of living, and there were mental exercises prescribed daily to train the mind. But it's not just about exercises. It is about brotherly and sisterly love, the unimportance of rank or wealth, and the futility of worldly possessions and attachments, an inner freedom in the face of the external world. So it isn't our fault, by any means. But though we may not be able to control events, we can learn to manage our responses. Believe me, I'm not in the least advocating a sort of emotional sterility. Tears can help wash away far more than the grime of the city, and laughter too allows us to distance ourselves from the jaws of despair. Indeed, if I had my way, there would be a chair of mirth in every university throughout the land. It isn't all our fault. It may not be any of our fault. All we can do, all we can hope to do, if we can't control events, is to manage to some extent our responses. Some of the examples I chose reveal the importance of getting on with life. We all have to suffer and make the painful inward journey, and then turn and look outward. The writer Cassandra Jardine, who died of cancer last year, put it in this way. Things don't turn out the way they were supposed to, but what can you do? You must take life the way it comes at you and make the best of it. Everyone suffers. Let's find the silver lining. Wisdom, courage, Stoic virtues. The Stoics believed in being above all prepared for life's eventualities. Every morning, before he left his house, Marcus Aurelius used to say, "Today I'm going to meet some difficult, obnoxious, rude people." I wonder what your mantra will be tomorrow morning when the alarm bell rings and summons you to face the day.